The following debate between TruthDig editor Robert Shear and Ralph Nader was recorded during the Nation cruise. For more, visit thenation.com or truthdig.com.
I'm not interested in personalizing this in any way. However, we do have very serious disagreements as far as I can figure out, and I'd like to express them. I want to say by way of preface that I ran as an independent candidate once for the Senate in California with the Peace and Freedom Party, a disastrous event in which I marginalized myself even beyond my normal place. I also ran as a Democrat in the Oakland-Berkeley area in 1966. I was thrilled with that performance. I got almost 46% of the vote. I convinced Ron Dellums to run 4 years later. We captured the seat, and Barbara Lee is our congresswoman from that district. And I bring that up because I do think it is possible to work with the Democratic Party. I think one can have positive results, and I'm very proud of my own foray into electoral politics. And I think that the parties have changed since that time. I think we have had party realignment. I think it would be naive not to acknowledge that. This is not the Tweedledee Tweedledum when Eisenhower was running against Stevenson. And Izzy Stone could say correctly, in fact, one of the bravest things I ever did is I wore an I Like Ike button in the Bronx when I was a kid. And I would still stand behind that. I think Eisenhower was a better president than Stevenson would have been. He certainly was a far better president than Truman. And there was a time when there were Republican moderates, and it was possible to say, you know, vote for one rather than the other, or talk about a third alternative when they were so much the same that one couldn't choose. That's not the case in the world we live in. There's been party realignment. And as imperfect as the Democratic Party is, it's the home of progressives, as well as some reactionaries. It is the battleground for progressives. I don't think we're likely to get a third party. The system is rigged against it. And this was my only reference to Ralph's campaign, I didn't see any third-party movement come out of that. I didn't see any building of any alternative, and nor do I expect one, nor do I fault him for that. I think given the system that we have in the society, we have a two-party system, it's probably going to remain that way, certainly for the rest of my lifetime. And I think that the Democratic Party, at this point in our lives, is not only the agency for change and the place where we have to fight our battles, but also that the differences between the two parties are substantial. And I am frightened to death of the direction the Republican Party has taken. It's a captive of an unholy alliance between a greedy capitalism of an extreme sort, as represented by Enron and Halliburton, people who have don't even have the vision of the Rockefellers, have a very short-term greed factor, line their pocket, take the money and run. And they've made an unholy alliance with the born-again Christian leadership, which is deceiving their membership into what we used to call false consciousness about their class position, their economic interests, and so forth, and basically betraying poorer whites. This was the Southern strategy of Richard Nixon, and it has been altogether too effective. And so I look at the GOP as the enemy camp. And I think what they've done is truly frightening. And I, for the life of me, cannot imagine, as was suggested, that there was not a big difference between George W. Bush and Gore the last time around. I voted for Gore, and I was very happy to have voted for him. And I don't think Gore would have gotten us into the Iraq War, and I don't think he would have given us the Supreme Court that we have, and nor do I think Kerry would. And so I was very proud to vote for Kerry, and even though I think he blew the election and so forth, that's another matter. So my own view is that we've had party realignment, that the Democratic Party is the place where we have to struggle. And I would close my introductory remarks by saying just compare the figure of a Newt Gingrich and a Nancy Pelosi. I mean, to my mind, that's an enormous difference. And for whatever defects one may have, I mean, I just don't see why one would blur that difference. And I'm thrilled that Henry Waxman is playing a leading role in the House. And Henry Waxman would not be playing that role were it not for the Democrats' victory in the last election. And I disagree with something Ralph said at the rally the other day. The only thing we've gotten is the minimum wage, which, by the way, is not insignificant. But we, in fact, have a Congress now not doing everything I would like it to do. That's the way that it works. You know, I'm not in charge. But the fact is that they're raising the questions. These hearings yesterday on the Tillman case were incredible. Waxman is a bird dog on these issues. He's not alone. And we are getting some accountability. And finally, I want to say something about the role of people in this room and of the nation. I disagree with what Dreyfus just said before in an otherwise wonderful presentation. I don't think the left is out of touch, but it sometimes works like it wants to be. And I think of the nation, I think, well, let's take the Weekly Standard. The Weekly Standard did not marginalize itself. When Bush came in, the Weekly Standard said, okay, we are now going to be the conscience of this administration. We're going to help guide this administration. We're going to work within. We're going to rally our forces. And they've been enormously effective, as have the neoconservatives. The Nation is right now the leading progressive organization in this country, not just a news organization. It's the leading institution in the United States on the left, no question. All right? And it seems to me that moving into this next period, particularly I would like to see the Democrats win, and I would like to see the Nation and people in this room take a responsible attitude towards that shift in power. And not marginalize themselves, and not raise every extreme demand, and not, you know, throw rocks at our allies because they don't fulfill our total agenda. I think that's destructive, childish politics, and I don't think it works. That doesn't mean you don't give up your issues. It doesn't mean you betray your soul. But it means you work effectively with your allies, and you try to educate those who don't see it your own way, and you become a serious force within American politics. And I'd like to see the resurgence of that kind of left in the future.
Well, I think one of the main differences with Robert, is a difference in frame of reference and sense of urgency. You can always point out half a dozen issues that the Democrats are far better than the Republicans. And my phrase in 2000 was the similarities between the two parties tower over the dwindling real differences they're willing to fight over. And let's measure it. Granted, you know, there are about 50, 60 good progressives in Congress, and they're all Democrats for the most part. We'll get to those in a minute. But take every department and agency. The evaluation of the Democratic Party is as the Democratic Party. It's not, gee, Henry Waxman's terrific. He is. You know, Markey's pretty good. He is. Dingell is horrible on energy and auto safety, and fuel efficiency, et cetera. But the general stand as an opposition party, the general stand now, tell me what difference there is in terms of the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Interior, the Food and Drug Administration, the Auto Safety Agency, the FAA, the Department of Defense budget. We have to go on and on. There isn't a single department or agency in the government that isn't overwhelmingly dominated by corporate power. The only challenger that could be around would be a Democratic Party. The Department of Labor is not controlled by labor unions, who are the main prop for the Democratic Party. I mean, it's the main support structure. You'd think that at least when Clinton was president, he would have liberated the Department of Labor and OSHA from corporate control. Instead, he strengthened the grip. OSHA in 8 years did not issue, under Clinton, one chemical control standard that government should have issued. Not one. It was the only eight-year period in OSHA since we got it through Congress in 1970 where that occurred. We're dealing with 58,000 dead Americans, work-related diseases every year. Even OSHA, Department of Labor, even knows. Look at the Secretary of Labor's under Clinton and see whether they made any statements about repealing the corrosive labor laws that have crushed the expansion of unionism in our country, or they made any ringing declarations of controlling the massive silent violence of occupational disease and trauma. So even there, they couldn't come through. We should always remember that when the Republicans get worse and worse, we tend to get amnesia about the Democrats, if not a little nostalgia. It was Clinton who signed into law the Agribusiness Act that concentrated further power in the hands of fewer agribusiness giants in 1986. He signed the Telecommunications Act, which all good liberals know was a concentrating factor of the media in fewer and fewer hands. And he signed into law what Bob Rubin wanted him to sign into law, the so-called Financial Modernization Act, which was breaking down the separation of investment from the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated in investment from commerce and allowed more city corporations, more concentration of the financial resources in fewer and fewer gigantic multinational financial institutions. Dr. Sidney Wolf, who monitored the FDA for years and years, said under Clinton was the worst he's ever seen, the Food and Drug Administration. There wasn't a single safety standard of any significance issued in 8 years for automobiles. And we go on and on. One of my favorites is, starting in the early 70s, we asked the FAA to put a regulation in to strengthen cockpit doors and door latches because of the hijacks to Cuba. And year after year, under Democrat and Republican, they refused to do that. And then 9/11 came along. So one can go on and on. The macro Democratic Party is a shade of what it was. Almost everything I proposed in 2000, 2004, and you can look at it on the record, would have been adopted or aggressively pursued by the FDR, Harry Truman, Democratic Party, but not later. Now let's take the progressives. There's a progressive caucus. It's now up to 72 or so members. But when it was around 50 or 55, and this was before 2000, we tried to get it activated. You know, a real hard minority in the House can achieve quite a bit. Look what the Southerners did blocking the civil rights laws, for example. Just a handful of them in strategic places. So we drafted 10 statutes that virtually cost the taxpayer nothing, but they shifted power from the few to the many. They made it easier for labor, for consumers to organize. They changed some campaign rules, et cetera. And we gave it to every one of them, one at a time. And weeks went by. We never heard. We'd call them up. Bernie Sanders, why don't you at least put them in the hopper so people around the country can say, you know, it's HR 28 and rally around it. It never had a chance. It won't have a chance. Dennis, even you, why don't you put these in the hopper so we have an agenda, a progressive agenda that will get some visibility and you can go on talk shows. Well, even he didn't put him in. So I had a meeting with the chair of the Democratic National Committee, had a nice lunch, and proceeded to go through these one after another, so-called pro-democracy agenda. And he took notes, and it was really great. And at the end of the lunch, I gave him a little paperback just for a joke. It was called Dogs Are More Intelligent Than Republicans. And it was a humorous little piece, properly pictured and so on. Just a fun book. So a week went by, 2 weeks. He said he was going to give it to the research committee of the DNC. Well, it's fine. 3-4 weeks went by. Didn't hear about all these proposals. Finally get a call from the Democratic National Committee Research Unit. He said, by the way, you know that book, Dogs Are More Intelligent Than Republicans? Can we have more copies? So I sent him a couple of boxes worth. Well, this continued. Again, after 2000, they still didn't put anything in. So what is this progressive caucus all about? So I write an article for The Nation about 2 years ago, 10 ways to reform corporations. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I get copies, and I send it to everyone in the Progressive Caucus. And not a single reply. This is a dead-in-the-water operation, and this is the cream of the crop. So what do you do with something like that? Well, Dennis now has an investigative subcommittee, and he's really doing some good things like tax-funded sports stadiums. And he's investigating those things. And, you know, while clinics, schools, public transit, and libraries crumble, Washington, D.C. is building a $650 million stadium for the Washington Nationals baseball team with tax dollars. So sort of an insane priority. So you try to go to stage two. You say, look, there are certain functional requisites for a just and humane society. And if you list them all, like full health insurance for everybody, a tax system that doesn't burden those who are least able to pay, a system where a foreign policy that advances peace in the world instead of pushes aggression and sells arms, a lot of labor standards to be improved and living wage, and right of collective bargaining, on and on. If you list all those, you find that it's corporations that are really saying no, no, no. You know, it's McDonald's and Burger King to living wage and Walmart, and it's the HMOs to universal health care and on and on. So you really detail it this way, and you say, this is the main menu here. That's what politics has to focus on, is corporate power. Because corporate power is commercializing everything in our life. And when everything's for sale, corporations are going to win. And if childhood is for sale, if education is for sale, if just about everything in our society that never used to be for sale, the corporations are going to win because they have the most money to buy. And so you make it very, very concrete, and you try to work with the Democratic Party. So in 1984, we hired 12 experienced people to go around the country showing how much better Mondale was than Reagan. And we never got any resonance from Mondale's campaign, even though we had the best materials. We'd go on Larry King and there'd be 15,000 orders for our booklets and so on. And one day, we learned that the doctors of the Center for Disease Control had finished a study showing 250,000 American workers went to work every day and are exposed to cancerous environments, carcinogens, particulates, the whole works. And they asked the Reagan administration for about $1 million or $2 million to send registered letters and urge all these workers to go to their doctors and get a checkup. And Reagan turned them down. And so we went to the Mondale people at the highest level and said, what a perfect issue right in the middle of the campaign. You can go to Pittsburgh, have a big workers' rally, and then point to Washington and say, these people didn't even have the decency after using your tax dollars to document the hazardous workplace that you're going to every day to just warn you, never mind shutting down the workplace or regulating them. And the answer was, well, we can't do that because Mr. Mondale, his platform says no more new spending. So we had a press conference a week later. It was packed. It was all over the country, the news. The second day, the reporters came in with, you know, this went to a foundry here or a factory there. So it was a second day story. The New York Times had a lead editorial. And the Democrat still wouldn't make an issue of that. So in response to Bob, let's go with his proposal. Let's see if you can really improve the Democratic Party, leading with the progressives and trying to give them all the things that they can use against the Republican Party. But when a party is so essentially decayed, so indentured to corporate money, so indentured to the Democratic Leadership Council and Al Frome, and so indentured to candidates like Clinton and Gore, who were high up in the Democratic Leadership Council, I'm open to ideas. What do you say, Rob?
Well, Again, with all due respect, Ralph, I think that it's kind of a filibuster in a way. I think you're begging the real question about where we are at this moment in our history. Your critique of the Democrats is, first of all, I think you should continue doing it. I never wanted you to stop being a consumer activist and attacking the corporations. As a columnist, I think I've echoed every one of your criticisms. I think I wrote some of the stronger columns on the Financial Services Modernization Act, on the Telecommunications Act. And by the way, Rocky, I pointed out to you the other day, Richardson was awful as Secretary of Energy, and he's the guy who put Wen Ho-Lee in jail in solitary for 9 months. I think I wrote 35 columns on that subject. So I'm not opposed to criticizing Democrats, and certainly what I was saying is I don't think The Nation magazine or anyone else should stop criticizing them, even if they get back in power. In fact, that's particularly when you should criticize and up the ante and educate and get the Progressive Caucus to be tougher and stronger. I think maybe Waxman wouldn't have had as good a hearings as he's had if Mary Tillman, the mother of Pat Tillman, hadn't been charging out there and raising questions and demanding it, and others hadn't done that. So I'm not asking for people to just rally around the flag here, but I do want to recognize we're in a particularly dangerous moment. And that is that the neoconservatives and the other ideologues and cynics allied with them have done what George Washington warned us against. They've put democracy against the national security, state, and foreign entanglements. We're in a very dangerous moment. By the way, I consider it shameful that the nation would have this cruise and not have one panel on the Iraq war. We are at war, you know, and we are in a war. We're in a war that is sapping the Treasury, will prevent us from pursuing a progressive agenda in the future. Every time we try to get money for anything, we'll hear about the trillion that have already been wasted. We know, as everyone from George Washington to Eisenhower warned us, that you cannot have this national security hysteria and foreign entanglements and still have a functioning representative democracy, still have civil liberty, still have a sane society, that this appeal to false patriotism destroys freedom. We have models of that throughout human history. So I think that we're in a particularly dangerous moment. And I think it's a moment in which we have to defeat this neoconservative vision and its allies in the Pat Robertson and other camps, in which now we have to defend Darwin and as well as, the UN. And it seems to me that we should recognize that moment. And in this moment, the only force that we have within the political system is the Democratic Party, for better or worse. We have so few allies in the Republican Party, it just is almost a waste of time to try to rally them. This is not the old GOP Democratic arrangement that we used to have. The moderates have been destroyed in the GOP. And we do have a strong progressive base in the Democratic Party. That doesn't mean you rally around the flag, support everything that comes down, so forth, but you do recognize, first of all, there is such a thing as the lesser evil, if that's the way you want to think about it. But in addition to lesser evil, we have some very strong progressive voices, and we should make them stronger. And so I'm speaking out of some sense of urgency that this is the most dangerous moment that I have experienced in the history of my life in this country. I have never been so frightened for the future of this country. And I think that if these people can continue this kind of reckless course, what they say, creating facts, so you go invade Iran or you invent some other situation or some horrible terrorist attack, if that had been a primitive nuclear weapon in Manhattan, we wouldn't be even having this discussion now. Democracy is fragile. These are scary times. And I think that putting some adults into watching the store, which is how I see some of the better Democrats. To me, Clinton looks pretty damn good. I would sleep a lot better if Clinton were president. I'm sorry. I'm not going to lie about it, you know. The man had some sense of proportion, some sense of accountability. Well, let's take the corporate world. If I had to choose between Bush 1 and that vision of capitalism and Bush 2, to me, there's a world of difference. Bush 1 at least had some sense there are other nations out there. You know, other people you have to worry about, that the UN has a role, that we don't have all the answers, that we aren't the center to everything, that diplomacy and trade matters. With George W., you have a hard ideological edge in this administration, the Cheney-Rumsfeld axis. It's very frightening. And so I would like to have some discussion here about how do we respond to the current situation. And I don't think you respond to it accurately by saying, I forget what you said, it's the, the tower, what'd you say it was?
Similarities tower over the dwindling real differences.
It's just not true.
No, it is true.
It is just not true. The similarities do not tower over these differences.
They do.
I'm sorry. The differences are enormous. And
listen,
that's why it really mattered that Gore beat Bush in that election. It really mattered that Kerry win. And we cannot duck that issue.
Look, first of all, let's take an easy one, Bob. The Democrats have become very good at electing very bad Republicans. They can't even win elections they've won. They don't go for the jugular when it's a close election. They won in Florida. They bungled it before, during, and after the election. Where were they when Catherine Harris was misidentifying tens of thousands of Floridians as ex-felons and prohibiting from vote? Most of them would have been Democrats. Where were they when they lost a good share of the Democrats in Florida? 250,000 voted for Bush in 2000. And the point is, they blew Ohio the same way. I mean, look, this is a party cannot defend the country against the worst Republicans in American history. That's where you start. That's your premise.
Ralph, please, listen. Take the statement. Do you really think the similarities between George W. Bush and Al Gore tower over their differences?
We're talking about...
Wait. Do you really believe that?
Yeah. Let me tell you why. They both pursued imperial foreign policies. Oh. They didn't invade Iraq. I mean, even a put bill wouldn't have been that stupid. But they had the same militaristic foreign policy. They never challenged the military budget. They never challenged the imperial foreign policy. They were the same on so many issues all over the world. I mean, let's not... Look, Clinton Gore bombed Iraq over 25 times. Sometimes just to divert attention from the Lewinsky affair, killing innocent civilians. They pushed the sanctions. They got the UN, one of the few times they got the UN on their side, they got the UN to impose those sanctions, which a task force of American physicians that went over again and again in the 90s said cost 500,000 children's lives. That's a lot of lives. So let's not sugarcoat. Clinton and Gore got through Congress, which Bush pointed to as he was beating the drums against Iraq, got a resolution through that toppling Saddam was a pillar of American foreign policy. So let's not sugarcoat it. The point is, let's say the Republicans are terrible. Let's say the Democrats are bad. They both flunk. What's our expectation level? Every 4 years, corporations gain more and more power over our government, more and more power over our elections, more and more power over the politics of the country, more and more power over all the things that we used to think are not for sale, which is a sign of a democracy, that there should always be sanctuaries that are never for sale. It's just a constant trajectory. And so I am asking you, how would you propose to strengthen the Democratic Party? Let's hear it from you. So it can become what you would like it to become, a beacon and a battering ram against the Republican Party. Another way of asking the question is, how do you separate the Democratic Party from the corporations?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm dumbfounded. I don't think you've answered the question. I mean, do you really think that President Gore would appoint the same Supreme Court? That President Gore would have invaded Iraq in response to 9/11, which had nothing to do with Iraq? Do you really think that President Gore would endorse torture? That he would have... I mean, it's just not true. It's just simply untrue.
That's fine.
This is not Al Gore, you know? It's just not true. You're inventing a boogeyman.
That's fine, but look at the bigger picture and the bigger issue.
That is the bigger picture.
No, the bigger picture is
Guantanamo.
The bigger picture is
the Supreme Court, Ralph. Come on.
The bigger picture is an imperialistic, militaristic foreign policy that's eating the heart out of our federal budget and militarizing our entire country and its horizons. And the Democrats, the Henry Jackson Democrats and the Richard Pearl Democrats, remember, they were all Democrats. There's a whole tradition here. The other thing is, look at the whole tax system. Other than Bill Bradley and that modest change in 86, that tax system is an atrocity. It's an atrocity in terms of perverse incentives. It's an atrocity to this day. I'm sitting in Senator Charles Grassley's office trying, and I got him to agree, to support putting all government contracts, military contracts, leaseholds of natural resources online. So everybody can look at them, like the Halliburton contracts and the Lockheed Martin contracts and so on. As I'm going out, he and his assistant saying, can you imagine Kerry and Schumer at the hearing the other day? I said, what do you mean? He said, we had a hearing to prohibit private equity moguls from using their 20% of whatever they gain from their investors as capital gains, you know, where they're paying 15%, and trying to get them to pay ordinary income, because that's what it is. It's like a fee. It's ordinary income, which would be 33%. And Schumer and Kerry were very unsupportive of that. Kerry said that he didn't like the idea of just one industry being singled out. This is a special privilege that even the regular investment companies haven't developed. And Schumer didn't like it because he came from the financial district. Here you have a conservative Republican from Iowa, for heaven's sake, asking me, what's with Schumer and Kerry? I can give you hundreds of examples like that. Look what happened just 2 days ago. $50 billion loan guarantee was put in the Senate bill by Domenici, Republican of New Mexico, and passed under a Democratic-controlled Senate. $50 billion loan guarantee for primarily new nuclear power plants. 25 new nuclear power plants. The Democrats, since January, they're caving on energy. They can't even control Dingell. They've caved on the war. They're about to cave on Leave No Child Behind. Check Jonathan Kozol on that. They're caving right and left. They're not rolling back anything either. That Bush, this horrible Bush, who's more horrible. I think Bush is more horrible than you do, because I sweated out two campaigns trying to develop a second front against Bush and giving the Democrats ways to do it, itemized ways to do it, real radical stuff, like support the minimum wage increase that's on the ballot in Florida, John Kerry. Huh? That's an easy one. It only won by 72%. He wouldn't campaign on it. Something that simple. So, what do I say to you, Bob? I want answers from you how to strengthen, change this Democratic Party. Give me your answers. Don't keep saying, of course, there's a difference. Yeah, there's a difference on Social Security, a difference on pro-choice. There's a difference on gay, lesbian rights. There are these differences in the social sphere that are really important. But the trajectory that this country is hurling itself toward is a trajectory of concentrated power by fewer and fewer multinational corporations who have no allegiance to this country other than to control it or abandon it as they see fit. And they've taken over Washington. Tell us how we do it.
I think you're being a demagogue.
Why? Because some people are clapping?
I hesitate to say that, but I really don't think you're engaging the argument. So let me state it again. I have no objection, not only no objection, I applaud your role as a social critic, as I do my own. To answer your question specifically, yes, we must criticize the Democrats. We must up the ante. I do it as a columnist. You do it as a lawyer, a public interest lawyer. And that is our obligation, and that's what the nation should do. That is not at issue here. I think I was one of Clinton's harshest critics when he was president on the very issues that you've outlined.
Of course, it's not an issue at all. Why do you keep repeating yourself? What do we do? That's the issue.
Well, first of all, we could be civil. It's supposed to be a conversation. And I would suggest that in terms of our role as social critics, I'm not talking about giving the Democrats a buy. I've never advocated it. I don't do it. And I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking you to recognize that running an independent campaign, which I gather you're still considering, that asking people to support an independent campaign, to suggest that the differences between the Democrats that are in Congress now and the leadership, Nancy Pelosi, Henry Waxman, and others, and the Republicans, is that the similarities tower over the differences is just not true. It's just wrong. It's inaccurate. And I don't think that's educating people. That doesn't mean you give them a buy. I'm for all for putting pressure on Henry Waxman and Nancy Pelosi. But to not acknowledge the differences of their approach, or forget even their approach, the difference between what used to be moderate Republicans and the true ideologues, the fanatics that are actually running this government now, the Richard Perles, you know, I think is to miss this moment in history. I honestly do. And I think, so I will repeat, I think that we're not talking about Ralph Nader or Robert Scheer or the nation as social critics. We're talking about how do you organize politically. And you chose to run an independent campaign with no base. You didn't build a party. You didn't build an alternative. There is no third party in the offing. A third party did not come out of your campaigns. You're now considering even another campaign, which will not produce a third party. And you, when you suggest that there is not a profound difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, you're kind of saying that we shouldn't, therefore, put emphasis into struggling with these people. I would take the opposite position. I think we have to have better candidates running. If we find some moderates, we should back them. But I do think that getting a progressive Democratic candidate now matters. I think people should be involved in these primaries. I'm not going to tell them who to support, but I do think, for instance, if Al Gore would come into the campaign, I would be quite enthusiastic in supporting him. I could get very enthusiastic about a Gore-Obama ticket, for example. I think Edwards has indicated a progressive agenda. I think Kucinich would be very strong, if not electable. I think there are good candidates out there. I think the people in this audience should figure out which ones they're going to support, and if they don't like the ones that are there, encourage others to run. But I think the next election matters a great deal. I think it is incredibly important to elect a Democrat and hopefully a better one. But I don't think we should be distracted from that. And I think you can hold these two ideas in your head at the same time. Be the social critic, up the ante, criticize them when they're wrong. You know, I think that's important to do. On the other hand, let's not lose sight of the fact that there is this cabal in this country now that has enormous power. And they're taking us down a very dangerous road. And let me just raise another question here. I don't think all the corporations are the same. That's a great slogan, you know. The fact is there's a world of difference between a corporation that's willing to do business around the world, willing to observe certain laws and so forth, and a corporation that wants to get wars in an old imperial model so they can sell us a lot of equipment and junk that we don't need. You know, there are splits in what used to be considered the ruling class, okay? And I suggested before, there's a rather important split between, say, the George Bush senior and the Iraq study group and their proposals and why George Bush argued against capturing Baghdad and the caution that he evidenced, and George W., who has the recklessness of the old imperial model, which we are now following. And I think to fail to understand that difference is to fail to understand the danger of the current moment, that our civil liberties have, and, you know, it's not true that things have somehow gotten, you know, it's all just murky. The fact is things are far more dangerous in very specific ways, and you have not addressed that. One is the Supreme Court. We have a Supreme Court now, thanks to these Republican appointees, that has absolutely no concern of civil liberty, separation of powers, any kind of accountability, is out of control and gives the imperial president the blank check. That is not unimportant. And I don't believe that a Democratic president would have had the same kind of Supreme Court. And I think to insist that that doesn't matter is to deny reality.
Okay. Let's hold the Democratic Party up to an opposition role. What could they have stopped that they didn't stop? They could have stopped the war. They could have stopped the tax cuts for the rich. They could have stopped any number of things, whether by filibuster, by raising the standard high and mobilizing public opinion when the polls were on their side on so many of these things, like tax cuts for the rich. He got through three of them. While he's building up a huge deficit, he got through three of them. That's never happened in the middle of hostilities in the American history. They always raise taxes, excess profits tax on to pay for the war. The Democrats controlled the Senate when the first big tax cut came through in 2002. Where were they? They just didn't have the guts to stop it. Let's take the Supreme Court, Bob. I was up there lobbying against Bork, and that was a success. It was a great coalition. I was up there lobbying against Scalia, and I would ask Al Gore, and I would ask Ted Kennedy and Paul Sarbanes, all these great senators, you're going to vote for Scalia? Well, he's going to win anyway. Well, I said, but, you know, I can't find a senator, not one senator, to vote against Scalia. And he wasn't hiding his candle under a barrel during the testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Scalia was confirmed 98-0. So then in comes Thomas. And George Mitchell, the Democratic majority leader, sitting in his office. And we're going in one senator's office after another. And it was really close. And, of course, Bush called Thomas the most qualified nominee that he could find. And he was the heir to the seat of Thurgood Marshall. And so we would go in one senator after another, say, is Mitchell really, you know, twisting arms here? Is he using his power? No, he's just letting us decide. He's not leading the way against Thomas. And the vote was 52-48. 11 Democratic senators crossed the aisle and voted for Thomas. So why don't we evaluate the Democrats in their opposition role? In their opposition role. What have they stopped? Now, the Democrats see nothing wrong with the anti-civil-libertarian move of knocking the third party or independent candidate off the ballot in the most vicious ways. You know, when you run for office, you're running free speech, petition, and assembly. And that doesn't seem to bother a lot of liberal Democrats. They liked Buchanan running, didn't they? But they didn't want our voters to have a chance to vote for the candidates of their choice, not by out-arguing us or having a better platform, no, but by maneuvering these state laws that the Republicans and Democrats have enacted to get us off the ballot in more than a few states. I don't consider that a civil liberties position. That's one of the last remaining areas of political bigotry that don't raise the hackles of the ACLU. When you deny the right of candidates to be on the ballot by harassment and phony litigation and all these partisan state ballot access laws, you are denying millions of voters their choice. And so let's not put the Democrats on too high a pedestal. Let us agree that there's a least worst operating here. There's a lesser of two evils. The point is, at what point do we say that there's a breaking point? What is your breaking point? If you support the Democrats, Bob, what is your breaking point? Can you give me a hypothetical of behavior by the Democratic Party or a series of behavior where you'll break with them and support an alternative candidate or an alternative party, regardless of their status in the polls, because you believe in what they're advancing? What is your breaking point?
Well, I would say the breaking point that right now would be a candidate who did not oppose the Iraq War for president. I would not vote for such a candidate. I would not support such a candidate. That's the breaking point for me, because I do consider the Iraq War and all it represents to be absolutely decisive, that if we have a candidate for the Democratic Party who does not break with that war, does not promise to end it, that I would not vote for such a candidate, would not support such a candidate. That would be a breaking point, yes. I could list four or five other issues if you'd like. I think torture would be another one. Could go down a line. But I think there's a different issue here, and we should address it. you're basically suggesting a kind of personal politics in a way. You're saying that you are the litmus test. That because you're not really telling us how to build this third party movement. If there was a viable, in any way, third party movement now that was an alternative, then we could have that discussion. If there was a serious alternative that was emerging, that had come out of your campaign, that we could rally around, then one could say, okay, that's a way to go. But it doesn't exist. All that we have left after your two campaigns is Ralph Nader.
No,
angry.
Not at all.
Yes, that's
not,
all we have.
No, not at all.
We don't have a movement.
No.
There's no green movement. There's no third-party movement. You didn't build anything. You didn't leave any legacy electorally. Electorally, you left it in all sorts of other ways. But you have not provided a model of political action.
Bob,
you have not.
I'm really amazed that you are attacking me for not being omnipotent.
No, I'm attacking. I'm attacking you for not being a political organizer, say in the tradition of Debs, who at least built a party. We've had third party candidates. Yeah. They haven't been all that successful, but they have built. And I'm not singling you out. I didn't want you to run. I don't hold you responsible for not. I don't think we're going to have a third party. But I'm just saying to discuss it as if it exists when it doesn't exist. And now you're even considering a third campaign.
Just a minute.
What could possibly come out of such a campaign?
You see, you're contradicting yourself. You're saying, on the one hand, that the system's rigged against third parties, and then you say, why aren't you building a third party? You're right. The system is rigged against the third party. It keeps third-party candidates, even if the polls want them on the national presidential debates, off the presidential debates, because the Debate Commission is a private corporation created in 1987 by the Republican and Democratic Party, and they don't want any competition. So the system is rigged in the ballot access. It's rigged in a thousand ways. And it's rigged in because most Americans are prisoners of a 220-year-old electoral college, two-party, winner-take-all system. And so they want to be for winners. So you can't start from a small base and try to grow, because even people who agree with you, and if you poll tested our platform in 2000, 2004, there are very many of them that had majority poll support. They want to be with the winner and say, I really like what you're doing, and I'd like to vote for you, but I have to support a winner. I mean, you'd get this in 40 states, which were either slam dunk Republican or Democrat. I'd be in Texas. People would say, you know, I really like what you're doing, but I don't want Mr. Bush to win. And so I have to vote for John Kerry. In Texas, you have to vote for John Kerry. I mean, Kerry never campaigned in Texas. There are 40 states when people could have voted their conscience. But the system is an imprisoning system. It makes people feel like there's no chance for the little guy. There's no chance for the underdog. And the two parties take advantage of that. And they collude in ways which, if they're in the marketplace, they'd be in trouble, as I said earlier, with the antitrust laws. So what we have done in these campaigns is we've given people an opportunity to vote for what they believe in. We have gotten a lot of young people trained in political activity. You'll hear from them as they go into politics and take civic and political leadership positions. We kept the progressive agenda alive. I mean, how many 4 years do you go through before you have a whole new generation that can't even argue for the estate tax or progressive taxation or Social Security if you don't keep that flame alive?
And then
we're condemned because all good liberals and progressives like Robert Scheer say, well, you know, you're just pie in the sky stuff.
Well, let me say,
and you're not building a movement. Okay. Well, let me tell you something, Mr. Scheer.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
When I see you on the hustings, when I see you on the hustings trying to build a movement, or even on the hustings trying to cover a fledgling movement, which I did not see you on, I will say that you're putting your feet and your brain where your words are.
Okay, Ralph, I don't want to get too personal, but as you know from previous conversation, I did cover your speech at Santa Monica College and a number of others, and I was appalled that you did not raised the question of welfare reform, and I felt that you were not raising issues of foreign policy. We have our own disagreements, but that's not the point here. I don't want to make it so personal. I want to talk about there are other heroes other than you in the society that I can get excited about. Now, let me just take my own voting pattern. I've gotten to vote for Sheila Kuehl, for instance, our state senator, and she's very aggressive on single-payer health plans, and maybe we even getting Schwarzenegger a bit over. He has at least accepted the idea that undocumented citizens, children, have the right to health care, which is an improvement. The progressive legislature that we do have in California, progressive leadership, has actually even brought this Republican governor. They didn't do it alone. The nurses, the firefighters, a lot of constituent groups put pressure on him. He went down in the polls because there was massive education. There was a distinction between the Republicans and the Democrats. I would say the Democrats in California have represented a very solid progressive force. I get nowadays, you can get to vote for a Henry Waxman. I mean, I haven't voted for a stinker of a candidate in quite a long time, as a matter of fact. I even got to vote for Tom Hayden to be my state senator at one point. And so I think there are plenty of people out there that have pursued the electoral process as Democrats. There are a few Republicans who stand for something, okay? And some of them are nonpartisan, like Rocky Anderson, okay? Antonio Villaraigosa, our mayor in Los Angeles. There are role models out there. Ted Kennedy, to me, is a role model. Okay, he has screwed up here or there, but I think Ted Kennedy has been an incredible senator. I'm enormously proud of him. You know, he's fought the good fight right down the line. So I just can't accept the idea that there aren't really good people out there that we can work with, that we can get behind, that we can recruit other good candidates and people to run, that young people should get involved. I know at my son, for example, after he worked in your campaign, which I think was a good experience, he did it over my objection, but he's his own man. Then he went and worked for Kerry last time. I think he's rather proud of that. I think he feels we would have been better off if Kerry had won. And he went to, in fact, Nevada to campaign for him there because it wasn't needed in California. So I just wonder, what is the message we're sending? Okay, if the message is we need to be critical, independent thinkers, in the model of a Ralph Nader, I began what I said. I think you're one of the great human beings of the last 100 years, okay? I really believe that, all right? And I'm incredibly... incredibly useful critic. I don't want Ralph Nader to stop being Ralph Nader. If there are other Ralph Naders out there, I want them to do that and so forth. What we are talking about is how are you effective politically as a candidate? That's the issue here. And what I'm saying is that you did not provide a good model and do not now provide a good model of being an electoral candidate. That's what we're talking about, all right? And in that respect, I would like to see people, okay, you don't like the candidates out there, work for others or support, you know, if you think Kucinich is the only good one out there, then get behind him, for God's sake. He's running, you know, support him. There are people out there. If you think Gore should run, get him to run. If you think Hillary is selling out, challenge her. You know, challenge her by picketing her, challenge her by denouncing her, writing emails, whatever. Yeah. You know, the fact is we have a process underway, and I don't want this to be yet another nation discussion that marginalizes us and puts us outside of what is really happening out there. We are in the midst of an election. We are in the midst of a battle with the Bush administration. I want us to win. I would like to see us have as strong candidates as possible. I would like to make our representatives in the Congress live up to the mandate of the last election. You know, I would like them to do more. Yes, okay, put impeachment on the table. Let's pressure them to do that. I'm not saying give up the fight, but God damn it, there is a fight to be waged.
Just as an aside, John Kerry wanted to send more troops to Iraq. He wanted victory, and he said in the first debate, we wouldn't have pulled out of Fallujah. 2 months later, Bush went into Fallujah. Massive slaughter, which will someday be documented much more than it is now, of civilians. And he had the Democrat leaders cover for it. They're always giving cover for the Republicans. But you know, in a way, this discussion is a decoy. We're both decoying. The central issue is who's planning the future of our country, systemically, year after year, day after day. Major corporations, and you have social venture network, you have some nice corporations like Patagonia and Seventh Generation and Ben and Jerry's and so on. You know, I'm always talk about these groups because it's a way to improve the criticism of the big guys. But these corporations are planning our political future. They're planning our electoral future. They plan our educational future, corporatizing universities, Channel One in the lower grades. They're planning our environmental future, if they can get away with it, fossil fuel, coal, more and more support on that, including among more than a few Democrats. They're planning our military budget and foreign policy future. They're planning our genetic future, for heaven's sake. They've patented thousands of human gene sequences. They're planning everything. And Washington is corporate-occupied territory. I keep emphasizing that if you have two or three impassioned issues, you're going to like the Democrats more than they deserve. If you like Social Security, although there's some Democrats that were fooling around with, you know, partial private funds and so forth and investments, but if you like Social Security and pro-choice, if you'd like gay lesbian rights, they look pretty good, the Democrats. If you're working on 30 or 40 major issues that span from the destruction of any kind of rational priority of our federal budget due to the military drain and corporate welfare, if you have 30, 40 issues like that and you span department and agency after department agency, the similarities tower over the dwindling real differences that the Democrats are willing to go to the mat on. Were the Democrats willing to go to the mat against Alito and Roberts? Well, they weren't willing. They didn't. They had far more power to stop them than they used. And it was pretty pathetic to watch the inevitability of the Roberts and Alito nominations. So again, if we start with the subordination of corporate power to the sovereignty of the people, with all that that means in terms of policy, like you do not live in a society that tells you pay or die if you can't afford health care. 18,000 Americans die every year according to the National Academy of Science Institute of Medicine. That's 6 9/11s. No talk about that. 65,000 people die from air pollution, EPA figures. Over 100,000 die from medical malpractice in hospitals, Harvard School of Public Health. All these forms of violence are shoved aside because of the terrorist focus in Iraq. That's a form of violence, and 9/11 is a form of violence. But far more people are being killed by preventable conditions. That's the key. Whether it's terror or whether it's criminal activity by a coal mine or whatever, preventable conditions. And we're not paying attention to it. And I've been to the Democrats again and again. Why aren't you doing something about all these massive fatalities? And they're sitting there even when they control the Congress. The Democratic Party today is not the Democratic Party of the 1960s and the 1970s. There is a convergence or a realignment. And the realignment is that both parties are getting worse every 4 years. And if we are so taken by the least worst option and we become a least worst voter, we are telling the least worst party, the Democrats, that they can take us for granted. And if they can take us for granted, they're going to take us. And that's the mistake that progressives are making. They're so freaked out by the Republicans that they make no functional demands on the Democrats in an election year. The anti-war people virtually shut down the anti-war movement with a few demonstrations. Well, you know, they didn't want to embarrass Kerry. Notice how many rallies there were in 03 and how few there were in 04. Now, and I'll end with this and let you have your say again. We analyzed 19 pro-Kerry websites in 2004 on their website. And these were labor, women's rights, poverty, consumer, civil rights, etc. Not one of those 19 were making demands on Kerry. Now, why? Well, they didn't want to embarrass him and let him have his own campaign and, whatever. They didn't want to make the demands. Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist in the pre-Civil War period, once said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And if you didn't make Kerry better, you ended up making Kerry worse. You ended up with a Kerry that waffled, that was ambiguous, that didn't have bright lines, which people like, between two major candidates, himself and George W. Bush. Now, if you're going to go for the least worst, if you're going to be practical, if you realize the system is rigged against third parties, then it is incumbent upon all liberals and progressives to condition their support for these candidates based on the impassioned commitment that they have to a certain course of justice that they think that the Democratic nominee is not pursuing. Look at the ravaging of our inner cities by merchant crime going all the way to Wall Street, predatory lending, the enormous interest rates on payday loans and so forth. And you'll see that, except for Edwards, and he's not as specific as he should be on this, that they are not making this an issue. We're talking about tens of millions of people who are constantly ravaged in their housing and the rip-offs that are going on and dirty food products going into the ghettos and ripping off their meager savings, etc., and not having municipal services go into their communities because they're into more affluent communities. And there's no position here by the Democrats. So what I'm left with is make demands on them. You want to vote for them? Make demands on them. Don't give them a free ride because they'll take you for granted.
Okay. First of all, I don't even know who these Democrats are you're talking about. There seems to be, John Kerry, for instance. I remember Kerry as a guy who did more on the fighting the Vietnam War than either of us. And we were both around. I don't recall that he was insensitive to that issue.
Did I say that?
No, but I mean, do
what
they
stop? What are you
stop?
Going back there
no,
for?
No, I'm going to finish now without being interrupted. I interrupt you. I think there's a demonization that goes on here, that anybody gets elected to the office, and if they're a Democrat, they stop being a complex human being. They stop having a conscience. And that's not the way I see Teddy Kennedy. I see Teddy Kennedy as an incredible person who's fought the good fight on a number of these issues that you've mentioned, certainly the rights of labor, consistently, immigrant rights, right down the line. A lot of boring. Ed Markey has fought these issues year after year. Henry Waxman, who I mentioned, there's a long list of these people. They work the issues. They don't become the enemy because they get elected as Democrats. They don't become saints because they run as Green candidates. We're dealing with people out there, some of who've chosen to try to be elected representatives, who do a damn good job. They don't automatically sell out. I think it mattered, for instance, that Nancy Pelosi, when she got in, did not put Jane Harman in as head of a committee. Jane Harman was owned by the defense industry. You've mentioned the defense industry. She's the one who fought for the stealth bomber and fighter. Nancy Pelosi pointedly would not appoint her to be chair of a committee. Okay, even though that the rules would have suggested that. Dennis Kucinich did get a committee chairmanship. Henry Waxman has one of the most important appointments. I've known Nancy Pelosi for many years. I consider her an admirable person. I think she's fighting the good fight. I can disagree with her when she doesn't push this issue or that issue. I'm not the majority. I'm not trying to herd those cats. I'm not trying to develop a coalition. I'm not really trying to get the Senate to have a majority to take a position. It's a different obligation than being a columnist. Being an agitator of one kind or another, which we both are, fine. And I'm not for lessening the pressure, but I will not demonize anyone who manages to get win office. Barbara Lee, as I mentioned before, she did vote against the war. In fact, at one point, she cast the only courageous vote, and I think she served. Take Barbara Boxer. One of my senators. I'm not as proud of my other senator, but I'm thrilled that I have a Democratic senator who has been as consistent as Barbara Boxer on the issues that I care about, So what I'm trying to suggest is there's room to operate in this electoral system within the two-party system, which we are saddled with. It's not going to change any time in our lifetime, or anyone else on this boat for that matter. And I think we have to talk about how we can work with it. And all I'm trying to suggest, without getting too personal, is that we don't need a third Nader campaign. We don't need another third-party campaign. We have to get serious about figuring out which candidates we want to support, how to put pressure on those who are not playing a good role, how to unify behind those that, you know, have a chance and can advance an agenda, because we're heading into an electoral season which is incredibly important to the future of this country. A lot is at stake. And I do want to address this corporate question. I think there are splits within these corporate circles. You know, I think, for instance, Microsoft, which doesn't make that much money off the defense industry. You know, Gates' father has been, along with Buffett, the main, those are two of the major voices arguing in favor of the inheritance tax. I think if you look at the work of the Gates Foundation, it's done a lot to try to deal with some of the impact of medical questions and environmental questions that you talk about. There are capitalists who favor trade and believe in it and will even accept some conditions on it, who recognize that a policy of old-fashioned imperialism and militarism makes it more difficult for them to do business around the world. And in fact, what I would argue is that the ideological bent of the neocons and of the Bush administration is a betrayal of capitalism. I think it's a betrayal of rational corporate activity. These people are following a model which the Germans, the French, the Spanish, and the English all abandoned because it was not cost-effective. It is not cost-effective to try to control the oil wells of Iraq and have to protect the pipelines. The Chinese, under communist leadership, are being far more effective as capitalists, signing up long-term contracts. There are splits in these ruling circles. There is enlightened capitalism, difficult as it may be to accept, and there's primitive capitalism. Enron, Halliburton, is primitive capitalism. They're taking us down a very dangerous road, and they happen to control the White House. There are more rational voices in the corporate sector. So I don't see this as you know, okay, move to socialism. You know, it's not going to happen. All right? What we have to talk about is how can we put adults back in watching the store? How can we make this more rational? How can we prevent this country from wasting its treasure, wasting its young people, getting people all over the world pissed off with us, hating this country? That's not good for capitalism. It's not good for the country. It's not good for its security. Okay, so it may not be very radical to suggest this, but if we had an Eisenhower running, whether he's a Democrat or Republican, I would be pretty excited right now. You know? And let me say something else. I don't agree that the Democratic Party is worse than it was in the 60s. I think it's considerably better. I really do. I think the Democratic Party learned the lessons, many of them, of the Vietnam War, including Bill Clinton, I would say. And by the way, Bill Clinton, you know, for all of his failings, did not invade Iraq, all right? He didn't, you know? And Bill Clinton did not appoint an elite to the Supreme Court. And you know, when you've ducked the Supreme Court question, I think, quite rather consistently tonight. You can blame the Democrats for not having fought hard enough and so forth, but if we had a Democratic president, if Gore had won, we wouldn't have had to face these choices.
Well, then why don't we? Why hasn't
that? Wait. Well, I'll tell you why. Because it shouldn't have even been that close. People should have been more aware of how dangerous the Republicans were at that time. And you did not play a good role when you said that their similarities, when you said that their similarities outweigh their difference, you were deceiving the American public.
You know, I don't know. You've got a... First of all, you're a genius at making our agreements appear like disagreements. How many times have I told you that there's a progressive wing to the party? I named some of the same ones. You keep going over the same ground all the time. The point is, it's quite clear the Democrats should have been landsliding the Republicans every 2 years, every 4 years, and the reasons why they're not are reasons that liberals and progressives not faced up to. And that is, they have told the nominees that there's nowhere for them to go, therefore they can be taken for granted. That's why Kerry thought he had the anti-war vote in 2004, because many of the anti-war people conveyed one way or the other that there was nowhere for them to go. So what happened? Kerry got a nice editorial in the Wall Street Journal praising him for his hawkish position on Iraq in the first debate, et cetera, et cetera. Again, here, let's look at it from just a tug-of-war point of view. You have the liberals and progressive here, and they have filled my ear over the years with their criticisms of the Democrats constantly. They would goad me to run on a third-party platform in the 70s and 80s and so forth. And you have the liberals and progressive here, you have the Democratic nominees here, and you have the corporate 24/7 lobbyists here and their power. They are pulling on both Republican and Democrats to get in there more and more and more in their grasp. Now, if the liberals and progressives have this, gee, you know, the Democrats have done good things and they're not all that bad, and don't challenge them from the outside and push them the way the anti-slavery party did, and the way the Women's Right to Vote party did, and the Labor Party and the People's Party in the 19th century, I hope you're glad that some voters didn't go for the least worst between the Whigs and the Democrats on the issue of slavery and voted for the anti-slavery party or the Women's Right to Vote party. And you've got all these liberals and conservatives, they're letting it happen. They have watched while the corporate Democrats have taken control of this party over the years. They have let it slide more and more toward the corporate positions of the Democrats, department and department, agency by agency. And so if you want to pursue what you want to pursue, Robert, you have to hold the liberal and progressive wing of the party up to higher standards. They've got to be tougher, because if they're constantly freaked out by how bad the Republicans are, therefore don't criticize the nominee, don't make demands on the nominee as a condition of support in the Democratic Party, every 4 years both parties will get worse. The least worst voting mentality has no end game. There is no end game, because there is no breaking point, because forever and ever in the future, one party will not be as bad as the other party. But both of them become worse every 4 years unless you change that level of urgency. Now, that shouldn't upset you.
It doesn't upset me at all, Ralph. And you know this is not an accurate representation of my view. I'm certainly for criticizing Democrats. I hope you've read some of my columns over the years. I wrote books on this. I was, as I said before, probably Clinton's strongest critic on the Financial Services Modernization Act, on telecommunications.
I'm not talking about you.
One second. I mean, so I don't represent a group that thinks you never criticize Democrats, and I'm not opposed to criticizing even progressive Democrats, and I do it all the time. That's our role. That's our job. We're talking about something different when you don't want to talk about it. Right, which is whether we should have a third-party candidacy, whether it is useful, whether it's a pox on both their houses, or, as I've suggested, for better or worse, I'm suggesting that there's room to operate, there's opportunity here to organize, short of a third party. That there are good candidates and bad candidates within the Democratic Party. There are primaries that we can get behind these candidates. So, for example, the deal breaker. I think people in this room should make it very clear that they would not accept Hillary Clinton as a candidate if she continues to her current position supporting the war. I have written columns saying that. I have said, I'm on record saying, I will not vote for Hillary Clinton if she has the position she has now. I've said it, okay? I'll even vote for Ralph Nader. I'll even write in Ralph Nader if Hillary Clinton is the candidate and she still takes the current position on the war. But that's different than saying there isn't room to organize, operate, that there aren't good candidates out there. There are. And I think we need, I think as far as the nation, I started by talking about the Weekly Standard publications of that sort. I think they would have destroyed their own, the National Review, what have you. They would have destroyed their own strength by attacking the Republican Party in the way that people around the nation consistently attack the Democratic Party. That doesn't mean they silence their critics. They state their case, but they say, okay, these are the people we're trying to work with and organize and so forth. You know, the Washington Times, I know, I'm on a show called Left, Right, and Center, all right? The editor of the editorial page is the right. You know, he has his criticism of the Bush administration, but he hasn't broken with it. He's trying to work with these people. That's his party. My view is that we, on the left, have got to stop playing at being effective and critical and so forth, and recognize the seriousness of the moment. Seriousness of the moment, and that we have some choices here. This election matters. And so instead of saying, pox on both their houses, which is basically what your argument is that the similarities tower over the differences. No, they don't. And so if it's Edwards who excites you, or Obama, or Kucinich, get out and work for them. Make this primary matter. But that's where political organizing and activity has to take place in the next year and a half, and people should not sit on their hands and just take them out and applaud when they hear the most radical statement.
Okay. All right. Before we go to the audience, let me just defense of third parties. In American history, they're the ones who put forward first the great social justice movements. We know that. 19th century, we know it with Eugene Debs, Norman Thomas, etc. I don't believe in a two-party elected dictatorship. I don't believe in a two-party duopoly. I don't believe in a two-party that controls the gateway to tens of millions of people by controlling a debate commission of their own creation. I believe in a multi-party, a competitive democracy. That's the only way we're going to get new ideas to get an airing. That's the only way we're going to get new agendas to get an airing. That's the only way we're going to get new human energies coming in. We've got a system where it's a one-party system for most congressional districts due to gerrymandering, et cetera. 93% of all House districts are Democrat-Republican. You know, there's no contest. People are left with one candidate, the incumbent. It's getting worse and worse and worse in that way as they carve up the districts depending on who controls the state government, Democrats or Republicans. I find it appalling that someone as promising as Obama is talking about leaving all options on the table against Iran. We know what that code word meant. He just said that we should pursue these terrorists right into Pakistan. If Musharraf doesn't do it, the U.S. military will do it. Does he have any idea of the consequences of that to even Bush's buddy, Musharraf, in terms of a revolutionary move? And this is Obama. And Edwards, what's Edwards got to say about the Palestinian-Israeli issue? Has he put forth the kind of constructive program that over half of the Israelis and Palestinians want in a bold way? He hasn't done that. He hasn't challenged the military budget. Have you heard Hillary Clinton or Obama or Edwards or Richardson challenge the military budget, which is eating the heart out of the necessities of the American people by taking huge middle-class tax dollars and shoveling them into the arms industry and into the corporate welfare kings, and et cetera? Let's have a little higher expectation level here and a higher urgency level. Everything that Robert said should be done, but it's not enough. I played this game 20 years, the least worst game. You know, Reagan, Carter, that was a choice. But then I went for, you know, Mondale, Dukakis, on and on, the least worst. They shut us down. They shut all these citizen groups down. We couldn't get hearings from the Democrats when they controlled Congress. We couldn't get agency petitions on serious health and safety matters like hazardous drugs and contaminated food and unsafe cars. They shut down the government on citizen groups all over Washington, not just ours. At what point is your breaking point? That's the key. And to have a breaking point transform itself into an alternative option so people who are sick of the two parties and sick of waiting and waiting can go and voice themselves on another part of the ballot. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with a competitive democracy? What's wrong with freedom of speech inside the electoral arena? Like the nation, they love my freedom of speech outside the electoral arena when I'd write an article or I'd make a speech. But when I went inside the electoral arena and exercised my right of free speech, petition, and assembly, they had a full-page editorial, "Don't run." Well, let me tell you something. I will never and never say to anybody, "Don't run," any more than I would say to anybody, "Don't speak." I would say, "If you run, I'll oppose you. If you run, I don't think it's a wise idea." When we opposed Lieberman in the Lamont race in Connecticut, and it looked like Lamont was going to beat him in the primary, reporter calls me up and says, "Are you going to tell Lieberman not to run as an independent? You've been opposed to him." I said, "I would never tell Lieberman not to run as an independent. I would say he can run whatever he wants, in whatever way he wants, but I'll oppose him. But I would never say don't run." There's a political bigotry operating here that represents itself in these terrible state ballot access obstruction laws that are so obstructive in so many ways that even a Bloomberg could get on the Oregon ballot and meet all the requirements, and the Secretary of State of Oregon can change the rules after the deadline and knock them off the ballot. That's exactly what happened to the Nader Kamejo campaign, and it was upheld by the Oregon Supreme Court. This is what's going on. So let's have multiple strategies. You have one strategy to get to where you want the country to go. But let's have multiple strategies. So, you know, it isn't that the Democrats have been right on their strategies. They keep losing. They lose to Gingrich. They lose the House. They lose the Senate to the most craven Republicans who have ever crawled up Capitol Hill. Now, that requires introspection. That requires an internal reevaluation. And I'm sorry that we don't. Let's go to the. I mean, is it okay we can go to the audience? Okay. Why did the Democrats get in IRV, right? Huh? Who knows IRV? Instant runoff voting. So if people voted for me in 2000 and their second was for Gore and their third was whoever, and none of the major candidates got a majority win, IRV, instant runoff voting, triggers that voter for Gore. Yeah? So if they want to get rid of the third party harassment, oh boy, what harassment. They can go with IRV, but they haven't. Only Howard Dean supports IRV. Okay.
I'm not sure. Yeah. You're talking about needing to change things. I think that now, if we wanted to change things right now, in the way things are, as dangerous as they are, because the Republicans got into power the way they did, that it would be more divisive than not. And I think that this is not the time to look for a third party or another way, because we need as many people behind us in order to change the country the way it needs to be changed now. And I think that the more there are enough Republicans now that are against the state of affairs now that they can vote for us. I'm very nervous. I don't speak out very much. But I feel very strongly about this particular thing, and I think that we need to make sure we do everything to get rid of the Republicans and rid of all the horrible things. And then when we get in, then you can change the things that need changing.
But it hasn't been working for the Democrats. It hasn't been working. If you don't push the Democrats to take more progressive positions, they are not going to get the number of votes. It may surprise some of you that the Democratic exit poll in 2000 had 25% of the Nader-LaDuke votes would have gone to Bush, 40% to Gore, and the rest would have stayed home. And if the Democrats had picked up on some of the rather traditional positions of the Green Party, like full Medicare and living wage, they would have won the election. And as a matter of fact, I think Gore did win the election. I was speaking to him some time ago, and he doesn't get into this blame, spoiler bit. He believes, as I do, and probably you do, Bob, that he won it in Florida and was stolen from him from Tallahassee to the Supreme Court before, during, and after Election Day. But having said that, the studies on the dynamics before Election Day showed that every time Gore went out after the insurance, drug, and oil companies, his polls went up a bit. And it also showed that had Nader-LaDuke not been in the campaign, Gore would have gotten fewer votes. Does that sound counterintuitive? Let me refer you to Professor Solon Simmons' analysis, and it's on our website, which we've kept open for exactly this purpose, votenader.org, and you will see the analysis. It is not conducted on Election Day. It's the dynamics between the candidates. I'll just give you a hypothetical. Let's say the Democrats picked up living wage and got 50,000 more votes in Florida, but they still lost by 527. But they picked it up from the Greens. You blame the Greens for the fact that they still lost by 527 because the Greens got 90,000 votes, only 15% of which were net Gore votes? I mean, it just doesn't work that way.
Since you've made, I don't want this to be all about, you know, whether Ralph should run or not, but I do think there's something we can agree on. I think the Democrats would be stronger if they took stronger positions on these issues. I have no doubt that Kerry lost the election when that question was posed. Knowing what you know now, would you have been against the war? When he gave the wrong answer, instead of saying, heck no, you lied to the Senate, you lied to the American people, you're a liar, and of course I wouldn't have voted for it, he would have won the election. So I agree with Ralph that the Democrats have a better chance of doing what this woman asked, that they defeat the GOP if they take a principled position on these questions. I certainly agree with that. And I don't think a candidate, whether it's Hillary or anyone else, who waffles on the war at this late date can win the election. I don't believe that. And so I do think that it's not a question then of asking the Democrats to be purists. It's saying that if you don't, the reason you won in the midterm election is because people thought you would be stronger on these issues. And so clearly the message we ought to be sending to these candidates, we will reject you because the American public will reject you if you don't come out clearly on the key issues of the war, torture, you know, and I can go down the list.
Good point.
Bob. You had spoken about your concern about this cabal in Washington. And right now, let's take a look at what this cabal is doing. They're rattling the saber about war on Iran. They're trying to manufacture consent for another war. And what are the Democrats doing? They're making the same mistake that they did with the war on Iraq. They're going along with it. You have Hillary Clinton. You have Obama. You have Edwards. All saying that all options are off the table when that military is talking about using military weapons, military bunker busters. This is really dangerous. And we're, as progressives, going to vote for one of these Democrats that's going to make another war possible? I can't see it.
Well, by the way, I mean, I don't know. Obama's been criticized here. I thought Obama opened up some important distance between himself and Hillary when he said that he would negotiate within the whole list of people who he would negotiate with, and that certainly suggested to me the right way to go. I think he's been stronger on the war recently. Edwards has been, I think, very clear. Kucinich, who doesn't get mentioned here a lot, if we want a protest person to raise the issues now, Kucinich has been unequivocal on these issues and is certainly deserving of our support. Let me just say something about Kucinich as an example. Kucinich was the mayor of Cleveland, and he got defeated because the corporations went after him on public power. He wouldn't sell the municipal public power plant. And the only reason he came back into I happened to interview him then and all that, and I've known Dennis ever since. The only reason he got back in is he was shown to be right, and even the Plain Dealer said that. Now, Dennis came in, and everybody thinks Dennis represents Greenwich Village or something. Dennis represents a district that has sent Martin Hoke to Congress, and he was Newt Gingrich's right-hand guy. And Dennis has made himself credible and getting 70-75% of the vote in a district that had sent this very conservative guy to Congress. So Dennis is an example of a guy. He may not play well on television and so forth, but Dennis is an example of a guy who can go out and talk to ordinary Americans and present a pro-peace, pro-human rights position. So I think there are Democratic models, and I think Barbara Boxer's victory, and people didn't notice it. Barbara Boxer won again in California. In fact, she was red-baited, peace-baited, everything else. She stuck to her guns. She did not cave in, and she won handsomely. So I think that the answer to your question is, yes, we should demand to know why Democratic candidates sound like war candidates, and if they continue to do that, we don't support them. That should be made very clear, just as the right wing has made very clear in their party they will not support people who break with them on their key issues. They will not support people who are pro-choice, for example, which is their right. So I think a deal breaker for Democrats right now is you have to be against imperialism, as is evidenced by the Iraq War, and for ending it. You know, you have to be for a living wage and substantially raising minimum wage. You have to be for incorporating human rights and labor rights and environmental concerns into international trade negotiations. You have to be for extending health care to something approximating single-payer health care. So I think you can have a Bill of Rights for Democrats that people in this room should adhere to and demand that candidates accord to. And if, in fact, they don't accord to that, you can vote against them or write in Nader in the next election. That is your right. It's, in fact, a smart thing to do. All I'm saying is we have a lot of room to operate in now. We have some good candidates, and we should be putting pressure on them to be better.
I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 because I live in New York. If I lived in New Jersey, I would not, because it was closer. The problem being, of course, the Electoral College, which makes instant runoff elections impossible unless the Electoral College is eliminated. We do not have a third party, a system that allows for third parties. It would be great if we did, so we could have what we had in France last week. We had runoffs, and so third parties could express their views and get heard. But without that, the pragmatic seems to be to the only way is to find a platform within the Democratic Party and make it a non-lobbying party, less of a non-lobbying party. And it seems that you could right now be one of those nine candidates right now vying for the Democratic nomination, and it would offer a terrific platform for you.
No, that was a question to you, Ralph.
Again, it's what Greg Kifuri said in the movie, Unreasonable Man. You don't go past February, and if you do the primary. Besides, the kind of compromises that they force people to make, including Dennis Kucinich, they forced him to make, totally intolerable, anybody who believes in freedom of the mind. They told Dennis to shut up, put his hand up in favor of Kerry, and they wouldn't give him a comma change on a Democratic platform. He wanted certain things that were any old Democratic Party would accept it. And when they were developing the Democratic platform in 2004, and they gave nothing. He was a loyal Democrat, went through all the rules and the primaries. They gave him nothing, not even an anti-poverty platform. So that's, apart from other reasons. Go ahead. See what happens when you have a little disagreement? It's wonderful.
My name is Len Zabransky, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My remarks are directed toward Ralph Nader. They're in writing so I can be more concise. Ralph, you played a very good role. You played a very good role as a social critic, but your candidacy in 2000 brought us a mean-spirited idiot for president, a lunatic for vice president who's also a fascist, and the Iraq War, and a Supreme Court that's the worst in our histories in the country.
Nothing new, said. You remind Ralph, of a lawsuit.
Years ago, where he... I'll repeat it. Go ahead.
Censorship! A guilty man, and he was found innocent. The judge said to the guilty man, the jury found you guilty, but don't do it again.
Okay, basically, he thinks that our campaign 2000 brought all the horrors of the Bush administration. That's roughly the summary. And, let me go through it again and again. There is nothing that kept the Democratic Party from picking up living wage, full Medicare, et cetera, and landsliding Bush. Number two, the Democratic Party stopped criticizing Bush's record in Texas after April 2000. Just like the Democratic Party convention told every speaker not to criticize President Bush, for a week in 2004, they had the nation's media on them, and they didn't criticize President Bush. And then when the Republicans met in New York, they ripped the hell out of Kerry. So that's one. Why don't you ask why the Democrats don't pick up old-fashioned Democratic issues that used to beat the Republicans again and again and again, as FDR and Harry Truman, et cetera, did. Number two, why don't you spend a little time on the thieves that stole the election from Al Gore? And number three, just look at the analysis of how the pressure to push Gore to take a few more progressive positions, at least rhetorically, got him more votes than he would have got otherwise. Let me put it again. I have seen no scholarly analysis of the dynamics between Republican, Democrat, and Green Party in 2000 that concludes that we cost a net number of votes for Gore. No analysis. All the analysis has been the other way. Check out these studies, Solon Simmons and others. Okay. There was an, even an AP poll, I'm told, 2 days after the election, which eliminated the Nader-LeDuc ticket and had it between Bush and Gore, and Bush won. So you just can't look at the numbers on election day. You got to look before, during, after election day on how this enormously elaborate strategy by the Republicans stole the election from the Democrats. So focus on the thieves, focus on the Electoral College, push for instant runoff voting, and you'll get a much more fertile and diverse competitive democracy.
So I'm told we have to leave the room, but I just want to throw my two cents in here and end on a constructive note. I'll repeat what I said before. I think Ralph Nader has been one of the great citizens in this country's history. And I don't think he cost Gore or Kerry in the election. I agree with that analysis. I think they shot themselves in the foot. And I think they should have run a more vigorous, progressive campaign. In Gore's case, no one has mentioned it, but he distanced himself from Clinton, who was enormously popular. And he failed to carry his own home state. And you can't carry your own home state. You haven't done something right in that connection. And so I agree with Ralph that he should not be held responsible for the state of the country in any negative way. I think he's been an incredibly useful person. I'm not being condescending here. This is heartfelt. I think he's a great person. And I do think he has the right to run. And I just hope.